Now, on the line, we have David Moore, and he's from Astronomy Ireland. And we're going to be chatting about the NASA Artemis project, the James Webb Telescope, and Astronomy Ireland's evening classes beginning next month. Good morning. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Thank you very much for coming on and chatting to us this morning, Dave. The NASA and the Artemis project, they were they have a bit of a setback, haven't they?
Yes, a bit embarrassing in the full glare of public light to see this huge rocket that, once it's launched, will be the most powerful rocket ever launched, successfully, hopefully, sitting on the pad there with leaks and temperature sensor faults that are stopping the whole mission from going ahead. And it's three, part one of a sort of three-part series to get them onto the moon. So this one, Artemis 1, is supposed to test the rocket that it can take tons of material, which will include astronauts eventually, as far as the moon and come back safely. The come back safely is a real big bit, because we bring spacecraft back all the time, but they're just coming from low Earth orbit, which is about 17,000 miles an hour, and that causes a lot of heat and friction, but we can build heat shields to cope with that. But coming back to the moon, you'll be doing 25,000 miles an hour, and if you double the speed, you quadruple the amount of heat. So there hasn't been any heat shields to do that since we had the Apollo missions back in the 60s and 70s. So that's a bit of a concern, because people will be on board. So that's the first mission. Then the second mission will actually put astronauts on board and fly around the moon. They did this in the 60s. The first Apollo missions didn't land. They went around the moon, came back to make sure everything was going to work fine, until Artemis 3, probably 2025, give or take a year, probably give a year at this stage, will actually land the first woman and person of color, NASA have said, on the surface of the moon, and then it's on to permanent moon bases and ultimately a stepping stone to Mars. So it's been very embarrassing to see this craft, which is now probably going to have to be rolled back into the factory, as it were, and have these leaks fixed.
Yeah, it probably does seem a little embarrassing, but maybe it's all for the good, you know, to get it right.
Oh yeah, NASA have said first and foremost is the safety, and that makes a lot of sense. Obviously, if you're an astronaut, you'd only put on top of what is basically a nuclear bomb. There's that much explosive power in one of these rockets, and I mean, it's roughly 100 meters tall. I don't even have any buildings in Ireland that are 100 meters tall, and this is just a rocket that they're going to build several of. It is a monster rocket. You're all used to seeing rockets going off, but this thing is like nothing we're used to seeing before. And it's got enormous power. It can lift millions of pounds of thrust, which means it could lift millions of pounds off the ground. That's thousands of tons. Most of that is the fuel, and it's hydrogen and oxygen. If you mix the two of those together, you get a very explosive reaction. And that's what the motors, the rocket engines, have to do. They're actually old space shuttle rocket motors. They're upgraded and adapted, but they pump hydrogen oxygen into the combustion chamber at extremely high speed. I think the old statistic was they could empty an Olympic swimming pool in 20 seconds. So they're ferocious machines. And then that material explodes effectively in a controlled way in the nozzle and provides all the thrust to lift the rocket up. So getting the pressures right and making sure the engines are pre-cooled, they have to be cooled or they would just melt, is very tricky. It's really cutting-edge engineering. And I suppose we all thought things were bound to go wrong. Perhaps you didn't think it'd be, you know, in these engines that they've used before on the space shuttle. But NASA have the best engineers in the world. They're looking at it. We're sure they'll eventually fix it, but when is the next question. There are only certain windows they have to launch this craft, because they have to plan everything of the mission, including the splashdown. So they can't just launch whenever they want. There are specific dates. And they've got a few more in September and then in October. But there are other missions that want to use this launch pad. So they can't just leave the rocket out there until they fix everything. So it's a whole nightmare of complicated logistics that NASA has to solve.
Well, I suppose somebody is getting slapped severely.
Well, you know, it is a very complicated machine, and had it gone off first time without any hitch, I think a lot of people would have been just as surprised as we are disappointed that it didn't. And because it's a manned craft, that's the important word, there are going to be people on board this craft. If you launch an ordinary rocket and it's got just a satellite, a robot, a computerized gizmo on it, if it blows up, it's a significant financial cost and years of the scientists and engineers' lives that went into building it. So it's a terrible tragedy for them, but nobody gets hurt. But when you've got a rocket that's got to have humans on board, it has to be perfect. And I think people have estimated that makes building these things about 10 times more complicated, because you've got to have backup systems and lots of sensors to check everything's going right. You can't just, like with a firework, light the blue touch paper and retire.
Am I correct in saying that when you burn the fuel, you get water vapor?
Yeah, in fact, if you look at the rocket itself, you'll see the main body of the rocket is actually what you're looking at, really, are hydrogen tanks and oxygen tanks. The vast bulk of what you see are giant tanks containing this liquid oxygen, which is extremely cold, and liquid hydrogen. So if you chill oxygen and hydrogen down enough, they turn into liquids. It's a great way of storing them. And then there's four rocket motors at the base that they're going to pump that stuff into and burn and create the thrust. But that's not enough to get it off the ground. They've had to strap two solid rocket motors to the side to provide additional thrust, just to get the whole thing up into the air and start the acceleration process. So the main engines do produce just water vapor, H2O, water, hydrogen, oxygen. But the side rockets produce more, shall we say, not as environmentally friendly byproducts. But they, fortunately, are only a fraction of the whole rocket system.
And because I think I just find this all fascinating. The American system.
Well,
it's rocket science. Yeah. Well, that's. Wait. You see what I'm going to say? The Americans use a system where it's all computerized, and it's a spark that sets off the engine, and off it goes. But am I correct in saying that in the Russian system, they're still using kind of like a big match to light the rocket?
Do you know, there's a lot of things I don't know about rocket engines, to be fair. And I know, Nash, you'll often see a lot of the close-up cameras filming the nozzles as they ignite them. You'll see there's a huge sparking system that's spraying the whole launch pad with sparks to ignite the first combustible materials that come out, and I assume that's how they light them. I'm not quite sure how the Russians do it, but you're probably right if you've heard that.
Yeah,
sometimes the tricks for lighting things are really simple.
Yeah,
one thing that happened very early on with the Saturn V, this is the predecessor of this SLS rocket, was that the vibration and the noise was enormous. So they found that by drenching the whole pad with water, that absorbed a lot of the sound. If you didn't do that, you could basically shake the rocket to bits. And there are sort of crash test dummies on this Artemis 1 rocket with thousands of sensors put into them. And one thing you can't really tell in the design of your rocket is just how smooth a ride is it going to be for humans. Some of the early rockets had enormous vibration problems. And some of them, I've heard the astronauts report, the ride is lovely and smooth. You just launch almost effortlessly. You pull a few G's on the way up, but you're not being shaken about as much. So the crash test dummies are going to find out, you know, will the human body be severely shocked? Let's hope it won't, because that would require almost an entire redesign or some kind of trick like that water shower that they have.
Absolutely, absolutely fascinating. But to move on is the James Webb Telescope. This is a fascinating bit of kit, and it is sending back images now, isn't it?
Oh, it certainly is. It's been the front page story on our magazine and made all the newspapers around the world when it was launched and then released its first pictures back in July. And we're all waiting for those. And this is similar to the Artemis project in that there were so many things that could go wrong. And fortunately, they all went right. And the telescope unfurled because it was too big to fit in even the biggest rocket we have. It had to be folded up. And then when it arrived in space, the petals, if you like, of the mirror have to be unfolded. And they have to be aligned to ridiculously fine tolerances, a thousandth of the width of a human hair, so that all the segments focused light onto the camera in exactly the right way. So that took them months to check out, to assemble, if you like, the whole telescope in space. It has a huge shield that protects it from the sunlight, and then all the cameras and spectrographs and instruments on board had to be tested to make sure they worked right. And the good news is they did, and we got those spectacular pictures. So anybody who doesn't get Astronomy Island magazine, make sure you sign up on our website today, because we're going to be covering the James Webb Space Telescope's best images every month, probably for now for about 20 years, because that's how long they reckon the sort of fuel on board will last. And unlike the Hubble Space Telescope, which is still going, they can't send missions up to service it. I think there were 5 servicing missions for the Hubble Space Telescope over its lifetime. And James Webb is 1,000 times further away than the Hubble is. So we just don't currently have any rockets or systems that can get to it to service it if anything goes wrong. So it's a pure robot telescope, and hopefully nothing will go wrong with it. And we'll be filling the pages of Astronomy Island magazine with Webb telescope pictures for years to come. And they are fascinating. And the science behind, the explanation behind them is equally fascinating as to what you're seeing. You know, things at the edge of the universe that were created long before even the Sun and the Earth existed, and why all these things are so important to astronomers.
And am I correct in saying that some Irish scientists have had a big part in it, and the Irish engineers, did they do some of the filters for the cameras?
They did indeed. Professor Tom Ray and Dr. Patrick Kavanagh at the Dublin Institute of Advanced Studies are the main people leading this particular project, so there's significant and important Irish involvement, and that's exactly what we featured in our magazine articles about James Webb. And in fact, Dr. Kavanagh was very kind to give us 2 talks this year. First in January, when they had successfully launched James Webb and it was on its way out to its parking orbit where it will look from. So that was sort of a preview of what was to come. And then a week after the first images were released, he gave us a talk because he'd been working on it as one of the instrument builders all during those months, seeing the pictures that the public weren't allowed to see, to tweak all the camera systems to make sure they worked the way they were supposed to. So he had all the inside knowledge. And at his talk, actually, he even showed some pictures which are not publicly available. You can still get that talk from Astronomy Island. It's on our YouTube channel. So if you go to YouTube, search for Astronomy Island, you'll probably find the lecture there with a little bit of work, or just contact the office and they'll send you the link. And it was an extremely well-attended talk, as you can imagine. And in fact, the headline on our magazine when the pictures were released from James Webb were Ireland's James Webb Space Telescope, because we wanted to feature the fact that Ireland's fully involved, and some of those pictures you were seeing were as good as they were because of Irish scientists.
And people have to remember, some of these photographs you're seeing, it's real back to the future stuff, because it's, you're actually seeing the past. You know, you're seeing the light coming from these things. Can be thousands, if not millions, of years old.
Yeah, that's what dawned on me looking at these objects. I think people don't realise how far away some of them are. And they deliberately looked very deep with James Webb Space Telescope in one of the first publicly released images. Hubble Space Telescope became famous for this. It peered out into space with its lens open for 1 week. So if you take a snap on your camera phone, it's probably 1/100th of a second that it takes the picture in. Imagine how much light you would collect in 1 second, and then go for a whole week, which is something you can't do from the ground because the sky itself glows very faintly at night. But in space, it doesn't. So they're able to peer out into deep space with Hubble for a whole week, 7 days, 24 hours a day, and that enabled to see the faintest objects we could possibly see at the edge of the universe. Well, the Webb telescope can do that 100 times faster. And they did that, I think, for 12 hours in this particular case, which is nearly a week of Hubble's time. And they were showing objects that are created soon after the Big Bang, which was one of the main reasons for launching this telescope. So the James Webb Space Telescope is really the James Webb time machine rather than a telescope, because it can see back in time, because things are so far away, the light has been traveling so long to get here, we're only seeing the light that it created soon after the Big Bang. So a lot of the objects you see are thousands of years old, sometimes millions of years old, and in the case of the deepest pictures, you're seeing things that are about 13 billion years old. So the universe did not look back then like it looks now. The universe was a much crazier place. The Big Bang had just happened. It was extremely hot. We think there were monster stars like we don't see today dominating the universe. And that's what scientists want to study, because that's what our sort of computer simulations tell us should have happened after the Big Bang. And now we've got an actual chance to see it and make sure, you know, that the way we think the universe came into existence that we can simulate on a computer really is the way the universe came into existence. And that's going to be one of the main claims to fame when the mission has looked even deeper, and it does plan to keep its lens open even longer to see back even further.
It's, I have to say, it's mind-boggling, you know, for us mere mortals to actually understand, you know, the idea that you're actually, what you're seeing, the photograph they're taking now is actually, as you say, 13 billion years old.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to imagine what that means. I mean, consider our own little lifespans, and even the history of our civilization. What, we have records going back at most 10,000 years,
yeah,
and we go back 1 million years, there weren't even any humans around as we know them. And, you know, we still haven't scratched the surface. It's 13,000 times longer than 1 million years before you get back to the Big Bang. So these lengths of times are, they're easy to say in words, but they're really hard to imagine in reality what they really mean. I mean, what's happened in those 13 billion years? I mean, we know roughly what's happened. There's roughly a trillion stars in the universe that we can see, and we're pretty sure we know how the big ones and small ones all work and how they live their lives and how they all cluster together in giant star cities called galaxies, and how they're sitting in a universe where the space between them is actually stretching. And it sounds almost like a crazy story, but it's the story that's been put together from the actual evidence. So it's not something people made up. They looked out there, saw what was going on, and were able to explain how it all came to be. And today, the maths and science that we have can explain right the way back to about the first trillionth of a second of the universe. I remember when I started many decades ago, we weren't really sure what happened in the first few minutes. Well, we've bettered that by a factor of a trillion today, and people are trying to work on not only what happened just before that, but also maybe what happened before the Big Bang, which is a really complicated subject. And we just love having articles about this in our magazine and stories about it from the experts who are working on it at some of the monthly lectures that we have. There's actually a monthly lecture coming up next Monday. If people want to go along to actually, if you search astronomy on Eventbrite, you will see that event is listed there. And you can watch it online from anywhere in the country, not anywhere in the world, technically.
And because we're coming to the end of our time. I'm just amazed that it seems like only 2 minutes ago we started chatting, because this is so interesting. And you mentioned there the idea of trying to think of what was there before the Big Bang. That is just so mind-blowing, you know.
Yeah, and I do a public talk about this. There'll be a new series of running in theatres at the end of the year. But actually, we have evening classes that explain to, or try to explain to beginners, 2 hours a night for 8 weeks every. Starting in October, so you can enroll for those now. And we try to explain, you know, it's simple stuff, the sun, the planets, the moon, how they all work. But then we do look at the cosmology, the Big Bang. How did the universe get created? What's the latest theories on that? At a level that people with no science education can understand. So we try to avoid all the maths and just explain it in as simple terms as you can. For instance, the way the transistors work in your smartphone is based on the same science that explains how the Big Bang came to happen. It's a thing called quantum mechanics that they'll explain at the talks. I mean, we've got the whole universe to try and explain here in less than a half an hour, so we're not going to succeed. There's too much going on. But we can whet people's appetite. So if you, again, if you go to our website, astronomy.ie, you'll see a link to those evening classes. And I'd recommend everybody to do them. Thousands of people have. And it's a nice way of sitting down for 2 hours, once a week, for 8 weeks, and having an expert explain to you everything. You can ask questions as well if you don't understand something. And after that, then, you'll have the magazine coming to you every month. That's part of the package deal. And that will keep you topped up with the latest discoveries as well. And doing all that has made Astronomy Ireland the world's most popular astronomy club. So we really are interested in beginners and people who are just discovering the subject for the first time, and like us, find it fascinating. You don't have to have a telescope. You don't have to have a science degree. You just have to be curious to join Astronomy Ireland. So start at astronomy.ie and see where it takes you.
David, thank you so much for chatting to us this morning. It's absolutely fascinating stuff. You know, the idea of that before the Big Bang, there was nothing. But
yeah, and
the Big Bang came from nothing.
I could try and explain it to you, but it would take several minutes even to do it fairly simply, because we have to put in place a few background ideas. Another thing we didn't even talk about is life in the universe. And there's a new radio documentary going out, produced in Ireland with all the world experts. We contributed to it as well. You'll find details on astronomy.ie of where to listen to it. And it's been broadcast on radio and online at 8 p.m. every Thursday. So do check out astronomy.ie.
Will do. So thank you so much, David. Thanks for coming on.
My pleasure.
Stuff. All the best. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
There we go. Absolutely fascinating stuff there from David Moore of Astronomy Ireland. You know, as I was saying there, before the Big Bang, there was nothing. So the Big Bang came out of nothing, so then nothing must be something. That just blows my mind. Absolutely blows my mind indeed.